90 in Bloomington, 85 in Mattoon. Up in Chicago, it's 91 degrees. In Indiana, we've got 88 in Terre Haute and 84 in Indianapolis. At Willard Airport, 86 degrees. And on Friends Plaza in Urbana, it's 88 degrees. The barometer, 30.05 inches.
Support for WILL comes from Subaru of Champaign County, featuring the standard all-wheel drive Subaru Outback with an EPA highway rating of 29 mpg, depending on conditions. More information is available at their showroom on Route 45 in Savoy or at SubaruofChampaign.com.
You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine. It's 1240. Well, officials in Normal are proud of their new $50 million Uptown station officially opening this weekend. Some in the transportation industry refer to it as the crown jewel of high-speed rail's U.S. future. Willis Kern has more.
On the eve of Saturday's ceremony officially opening the multimodal transportation facility, an international conference on high-speed rail is convening in Philadelphia. One of those in attendance is Kevin Brubaker, deputy director of the Chicago-based Environmental Law and Policy Center. He says those who criticize Uptown Station's multi-use as a city hall and other venues are missing the center's transformative benefits.
I think Normal has done the right thing by embracing all the potential that high-speed rail brings to its community, by creating a new community center that acts as everything from city hall to community meeting rooms to a station for buses and trains and bicycles. They've created a win-win-win situation. It should be a model for all communities.
Why don't more communities do what Normal did?
Well, unfortunately, we're in the midst of a hyper-partisan debate in this country over whether high-speed rail makes sense or not, and we're just hopeful that more people will listen to the real-world experience of places like Normal instead of to the naysayers and pundits that are pontificating on this issue.
Well, let's try and nail down some of the arguments there that these naysayers are throwing out there about high-speed rail in general. One criticism is that the benefits are overstated. Is that the case?
I think Normal proves that when you build it, they will come. The city of Normal, as you know, has seen more than $230 million in private investment even before the train started running, simply in anticipation of the new economic vitality that better transportation services bring.
Another criticism is that high-speed rail uses old technology that's really not transformational.
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by old technology. High-speed rail is in use all over the world. It's a technology that is continually evolving. While it's true that the incremental rail service that's coming to Normal at 110 miles an hour is not the Japanese 200-mile-an-hour trains, it's an important first step. I think we need to dip our toes in the water before we plunge headlong.
Another criticism we hear about with high-speed rail is that the travel culture in the United States just won't accept it. We accepted an interstate system for cars 50-some years ago, and we've been ingrained in that, and we're not going to accept mass transit via rail. Is that a valid argument?
Well, you know, American culture is not a static thing. It's always evolving. That's what makes us such an exciting country. While it's true that prior generations for a few decades was in love with the automobile, that love affair is really fading today. The younger generation is preferring to spend money on iPods and iPads rather than cars. We're seeing far fewer driver's license registrations, far less automobile use among the younger generation. I think America's ready to embrace high-speed rail.
Is it possible to satisfy some of the critics of high-speed rail, particularly those who talk about too much federal spending in an era when many critics say federal spending should be going way down instead of up? Is it valid to say that transportation is a vital service the government should be paying for, or should there be more private funds to get this off the ground and rolling?
Well, you know, I'm talking to you today from Philadelphia, really the cradle of American democracy, where 13 colonies came together to create a new country. One of the primary reasons they did that was to be able to develop interstate transportation services. One of the first things this country did once it was created was to build the post roads. It was acknowledged from the very, very infancy of our country that a central role of the federal government is to build our transportation infrastructure. And yeah, that costs money.
Many proponents of high-speed rail point to a highly successful European model, yet we're now learning France's budget minister is recommending that that country not follow through on planned high-speed expansion, delaying the purchase of 14 new TGV train lines simply because of the cost, $184 billion U.S. dollars. So even in cultures where high-speed rail is successful, there are some issues. Is this a cautionary tale for the U.S. going forward?
I think the lesson is a fairly obvious one, that high-speed rail doesn't always make sense in all places at all times. I don't think we or others have ever put it forth as the solution to every problem our society faces. But look, it's a system that has already provided more than 15 billion trips worldwide. That's an average of more than 2 trips for every man, woman, and child living on the planet. High-speed rail is successful. It is widely acknowledged in the rest of the world as the future form of transportation investments that they need to be making. And they're a little perplexed that the United States has not yet joined them. We're hoping that Normal and other cities like that really show the rest of this country that high-speed rail can work, does bring economic vitality and jobs we need.
The Environmental Law and Policy Center's Kevin Brubaker says the fact that Normal is opening up a new train station and receiving the benefits of high-speed rail just days after California decided to begin building it is indicative of the Midwest's no-nonsense style of just getting it done that Brubaker says makes a lot of sense. I'm Willis Kern.
It's 1246. Woody Guthrie was born in Okemo, Oklahoma, 100 years ago tomorrow. NPR's Vince Pearson reports on Guthrie's enduring musical legacy with a look at Woody at 100, a new book and CD set from Smithsonian Folkways.
These are some of the takeaways from a new book and CD collection called Woody at 100. It's a coffee table book filled with glossy prints of Guthrie's artwork and 3 music CDs. The book was written by Jeff Place and Robert Santelli. I visited Place at the Smithsonian Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage in Washington, where he works as an archivist.
Yeah, I thought we'd step back into the great vault, you know, full of like walls and walls of recordings.
On the shelves are hundreds of old Guthrie records. A big map drawer holds stacks of original paintings and drawings. And there are some personal items, too, like this old American history book.
It was a book that belonged to Woody, and he's basically going through the entire book and underlined every sentence, and he's in the margins debating Jefferson and people like that about, you know, the politics, you know, beginnings of the United States. So, you know, people who want to know kind of what Woody was thinking, you can really kind of get in here and do that.
Place says he's been researching Woody Guthrie for 25 years, and he's still turning up new material.
That's just Woody in general. Woody was such a creative individual. He'd be wandering along somewhere and record something and leave it behind. So I keep finding, you know, tape boxes with nothing on them. When you put it on, and it's a Woody Guthrie track you haven't heard before.
The book includes some of the best of these finds, including 4 never-before-released tracks thought to be Guthrie's earliest recordings.
Oh, I've been skidding around down on Skid Row. I've been skidding around down on Skid Row. It's the skiddiest street in town. I've been skidding up and down. I've been skidding up and down on the Skid Row.
Guthrie was a little-known country singer when he recorded this song in 1939. He was working for a politically oriented radio program in California that was popular among dispossessed Oklahomans who'd moved west to find work. Here's Guthrie in his own words introducing another song from that era.
As I rambled around over the country and kept looking at all these people, seeing how they lived outside like coyotes, around in the trees and timber and under the bridges and along all the railroad tracks and in their little shack houses that they built out of cardboard and tow sacks and old corrugated iron. It just struck me to write this song called I Ain't Got No Home in the World Anymore. I ain't got no home, I'm just a-rambling around.
Robert Santelli is a co-author of Woody at 100. He says Guthrie felt a responsibility to write songs about the problems he saw. Santelli, who also happens to run the Grammy Museum in Los Angeles, believes this activist spirit is lacking in today's popular music.
And so the whole hope with the celebration of Woody Guthrie is not only to celebrate his life and the importance of his music, but also to demonstrate how music can act as an agent for social and political change in this country.
He hopes young musicians who hear the music and read the book will follow Guthrie's lead. Vince Pearson, NPR News.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world.
Support for WILL comes from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods on the corner of 6th and University in Champaign, providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of foods from around the world, including cheeses, olives, spices, hot sauces, olive oils, and more. World Harvest invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 13th of July, 2012. It's the anniversary of the 1977 blackout in New York City, a day when lightning struck three times, hitting Con Edison substation, shutting down the power grid. The city went dark at about 9:30 p.m. Kennedy and LaGuardia Airport shut down. Tunnels in and out of the city were closed. Thousands of people had to be evacuated from the subways. There had been a similar blackout in 1965, and people faced it for the most part with good humor. But in 1977, New York was in the midst of an economic crisis, high unemployment. There was a serial killer, Son of Sam, on the loose. There was a brutal heat wave going on. And in the 25 hours it took workers to restore power, more than 1,600 stores were looted, more than 1,000 fires set, nearly 3,800 looters arrested, damage later estimated at $300 million. It's the birthday of the poet John Clare, born in Northamptonshire, England, 1793, to a poor rural family. He suffered from malnutrition, as a result of which he never grew taller than 5 feet. His first book of poems, published when he was 27, was a great success, but despite that, he felt inferior to other poets of the day, Byron and Keats and Coleridge, because they were educated and he was not. In 1837, he entered an asylum, suffering from depression and alcoholism, stayed there for 4 years, escaped. 5 months later, he was committed to a lunatic asylum in Northampton, where he spent the rest of his life and where he wrote many of his best poems. William Wordsworth wrote one of his best poems on this date in 1798. He was on a walking tour with his sister in the Wye Valley, and he said that he wrote the whole thing in his head, memorized it, never changed a single one of its 1,200 words, and did not write it down until he and his sister arrived in Bristol 4 or 5 days later. The poem was lines composed a few miles above Tintern Abbey. Tintern lies near the River Wye in Monmouthshire, Wales. And it's the birthday of the Nigerian playwright and poet Wole Soyinka, born in Abeokuta, Nigeria, 1934, first African to win the Nobel Prize in Literature, and also a pro-democracy